Lecture S12, November 8, 1962, electrostatic analogs. Lecture S12, November 8, 1962, electrostatic analogs.
I'm sorry, I put you on too soon before everybody got in here. Okay. For those who came in late, don't forget the Mordeo. I want you out there. Total amount of information which has been acquired on about the physical world since the beginnings of the scientific progress is rather enormous. And it seems almost impossible that people can accumulate all this information. That is, not that any one person could know a reasonable fraction of it. But it does turn out to be quite possible for a physicist to remain a physicist rather than to become a specialist in some form. The reason for this is twofold. In the first place, there are great principles which go and cross all the different kinds of phenomena, such as the principle of conservation of energy or of angular momentum. So that a thorough understanding of those is an understanding of a great deal all at once. In addition, there's this, that the more or less complicated circumstances, such as the behavior of solids under compression, does really depend upon electrical and quantum mechanical forces. And so by knowing more about the fundamental laws, it is at least some possibility of understanding a great deal at the beginning, and perhaps not all the details, of course, of the phenomena in complex situations. And finally, there's a most remarkable coincidence of a kind. And that is that the equations for many different physical situations appear exactly the same. Of course, the letters look different. One has to substitute one letter for another. But that done, the equations are exactly the same. This means that having studied one subject, you have a great deal of direct, precise and complete information about another. The subject of electrostatics we are now finished with. We're going to go on to magnetism and electrodynamics. But before I leave the thing, I would like to illustrate this point that we have learned simultaneously with electrostatics a number of other subjects. And so the subject of this lecture is to point out that the equations of electrostatics are repeated in other places in physics. And also to point out that therefore, by a direct translation of the solutions, because the same equations have the same solution, it's possible to tell a lot about to solve problems in other fields as easily or as difficultly as it is in electrostatics. The equations of electrostatics, I remind you, appear as follows. If we take the case with dielectrics to make the most general situation, we have that the divergence of some constant, the dielectric constant, times a vector times a vector, the electric field, is equal to a scalar in position, which is the charge density over epsilon naught. That's just a scale. That the other equation is that the curl of E is zero. Now, equivalent to this pair is another pair, which is that the E is given by the gradient of phi, and that the divergence of K gradient phi is equal to rho over epsilon zero. In fact, even if you never had the electric field, if you have the main equation that you have, sorry, there's a minus sign. The main equation that you have to solve is this. And the gradient happens to have an interpretation as the electric field. Now, the point is that there are many physics problems which have a mathematical equation which is of the form of divergence of some function times the gradient of another one is equal to a certain scalar. And therefore, since we know how a good deal, or as much as we know about electrostatics, can be carried over into that other subject, and vice versa. If the other subject has some particular characteristics that are known, then you can use that to study the electrostatic problem and so on. So I'd like now to take a series of examples from different fields which produce the same equation. The first example is one that we've already discussed, and that's heat conduction. We talked about the vector H, which imagine a block of material, which now need not be exactly homogeneous, may consist of different materials in different places, that there's a temperature in different places, and as a consequence, there's a flow of heat. And the heat flow is represented by a vector because it's in some direction, and this vector represents the amount of heat energy which flows through a square centimeter per second. In fact, we used it to describe the properties of the divergence, and we know that the divergence represents the heat which is going away per unit volume from a volume. Or you can write these things in integral form, just as you can over here, with a Gauss's law that says the flux through the surface is equal to the rate of change of what's inside, and so on. And I will not bother to translate the equations back and forth between the differential form and the Gaussian form, integral form, because that's all exactly the same as in electrostatic. This, then, is the rate of loss of heat of heat in a unit volume per second, and depends on the problem what it equals. For example, suppose that there's a source, there's a heater inside the volume, that somewhere, for example, there's either a radioactive source or an electrical heater, or there's electric current going through that generates heat and so on. So that first there would be a rate of generation. Let me call S is the heat or the energy, heat energy generated inside a volume, generated per unit volume per second. In addition to that, if there is no heat, then there will be a loss of the energy that's in there. There will be a minus, let's say, I don't like to use Q because we use it for charge, so I'll just write it in. Heat energy per unit volume. The internal energy. The internal energy per unit volume with time. We're not going to discuss the equations which involve the time today, because we're making an analogy to electrostatics in which nothing depends upon the time. And so in this particular problem, we'll consider a steady heat flow problem in which there are sources and then things have gotten into equilibrium, so there's no changes with time. Then so far we have divergence H equals S, which is not enough, because we still have to get another equation to finish that, to find out how things vary. Now, the other equation is this, that in many materials, the heat current is proportional in a given piece of material to how much the temperature differs from one point to another. And the more rapidly the temperature varies, the faster the heat current. In fact, as we've already discussed, if there's a difference in temperature, the difference in the rate of change of temperature with distance is the thing which generates the heat flow, and that the heat current is proportional to that, with a constant proportionality, which I'll call cap K, and which is called the heat conductivity, and is K, H, of course, in the same direction as the gradient of T, and that this first law is more than just the conservation of heat, and the second law is a special property of some substances. If the substance varies from place to place in its properties, then K will be a function of position. Well, now, this pair of equations, then, is the same as these, as is immediately apparent by substituting the second one into the first. Incidentally, as I keep forgetting, there's a minus sign. Of course, the heat flows from hot to cold, not the other way around. So the final equation that we have is that the divergence of kappa grad T is equal to the heat generated, minus S. And this is the same form as this. And therefore, heat problems and electrostatic problems are the same. In fact, we've already noticed that a point heat source produces a temperature distribution which varies as 1 over R, and a heat flow which varies as 1 over R squared, which is nothing more than a translation of the other equation, which says that a point charge generates a potential which varies as 1 over R, or electric field, which varies as 1 over R squared. Therefore, we can solve heat problems as easily as we can solve electrostatic problems, and I just take an example. Simple example. Suppose we have a pipe at temperature T1, and the pipe is a radius A, and it's generating some heat in there. Let's say it's a wire, for example, carrying a current. And it's covered with an insulating material, which has a conductivity kappa in here. And the outside radius is B. And the outside is kept at temperature T2. And this represents a heat insulation, and we try to find out how much heat will be lost by the hot water pipe or the wire or whatever it is that's in the center. So let's say it's a hot water pipe with the insulation. Let the total amount of heat lost by the thing be called sigma. That's what we're trying to find. Then how can we solve this problem? Well, you've got differential equations. But it's the same as electrostatics, and we can do it the same way. The analog problem is that there's a T. Let's see, T corresponds to phi. Oh, the analog problem is that there's a conductor here with a certain phi potential. There's another conductor here, another phi. And the problem that we're trying to find is how much heat is lost. Well, the heat rate corresponds to the electric field, and so we're trying to find something about the flux of the electric field out here. At any rate, let's solve it more or less directly from here by using our electrostatic method. If we make a Gaussian cylinder here of length L, let's suppose that the length is L, then we have the following, that the vector heat flow gradient K gradient T, this thing, multiplied by the area of the surface, which is 2 pi r d times L, must be equal to the total amount of S inside, which is what we're calling sigma, the total generated heat inside. This is Gauss's theorem. And so right away, then, the gradient of temperature is the rate of change of temperature with radius, because we suppose it only depends upon radius. And we find that the temperature changing with radius, like kappa L times 2 pi R. And therefore, the temperature at any place is sigma over capital L times 2 pi log R. And the temperature between the two surfaces is sigma over kappa L times 2 pi times the logarithm of B over A. And therefore, the sigma, the total heat lost, is equal to kappa L over 2 pi, no, times 2 pi. I hope if I haven't made a quick mistake in here, divided by the logarithm of B over A times the temperature difference. And this, I remind you, in electricity, we had a law that said that the charge on a long length between two things here would be 2 pi epsilon naught times the length over the logarithm of the radius ratio times the phi 2 minus phi 1. That is to say, the voltage difference. And in short, this is a capacitance of a cylindrical condenser, and it's exactly the same problem and exactly the same solution and so on. So we know how much heat is lost by a pipe with a given temperature difference. However, let me go a little further and take another example, again with heat flow, because best to learn, idea of the analogies by one that we understand easiest, and then we'll go to other examples. I have this problem. I have, let's say, this is the surface of the earth or the surface of a metal block or anything like that, that a heat cannot flow up here. It's air. It doesn't conduct heat. The heat only flows down here. And that inside this material at a certain depth, there's a heat source. Perhaps it was an atomic bomb that went off that's generating heat, or is a radioactive source inside of a block of iron. It's 100 possibilities. But anyway, the problem is there's a heat source, nearly a point at a distance A. The strength of the source is sigma. Sigma corresponds to the charge, you see. This is the charge density. And sigma is a total amount of heat source is a charge in the electric case. Is at a distance A from the surface, and the condition is that there be no flow in here, and the problem is to determine the distribution of temperature at the surface. How hot is it right above and at different distances? How do we do it? Well, now we have a problem with two different materials with different K. You say, oh, that's something like an electrical problem. Probably the analog is this is space and this is a conductor or some such thing. We have to get the analog. What is the physical condition here? The physical condition is that the normal component of H on a surface to an insulator like this is zero. There's no heat flow out. Now, in what electrostatic problem do we have a surface in which the condition is that the normal component of the electric field, which is the analog, is zero? There is none. So that one of the things we have to watch out for is that the limitations of studying in one field may produce the result that we've only analyzed the equation for a limited cases of boundary conditions for some physical reason in the original problem, while actually, from a mathematical standpoint, there's a wider class of problems. So, and this is a wider class. There isn't any analogy of this. If you would like to look at it a little bit, you could say that the K, the conductivity in this region, is zero. And the physical analog can only mean that the dielectric constant is zero. A dielectric constant is never zero in any real practical situation. It's almost always greater than one, and therefore one or greater. And we haven't got that physical analog, but we can imagine that we have. But nevertheless, we can solve the thing in an analogous way that we solved the case of a plane, a metal surface, in which we had a different condition, which was that the potential was a constant. Because if we can invent a new problem artificially by putting artificial image sources here that will automatically produce Hn equals zero, then we will have the solution that we want. And then after some mental gyrations, it's clear that if you put another charge up here of plus charge in electricity, then the field is always this way. It can't have a normal component because that balances out. And so the normal component is zero, and we've got the problem solved. And therefore, the temperature everywhere is equal by a direct analog to two-point charges. Let's call Z the direction this way. The temperature from a single-point source, I may say, is sigma over 4 pi kappa times R, the radial distance, which is the analog of total charge over 4 pi epsilon naught R, of course. And so in exactly this way, we have the sigma over 4 pi kappa times 1 over the square root of Z minus A square plus X square plus Y square, because that's the distance, if X and Y represent the horizontal distance, from this charge. And then we have the other charge with the same sign, unlike the case that I had the images for the metal surface and electrostatic. And we get this. The original problem asked for the temperature at the surface, and that's Z equals zero. And to make it easy to calculate, let's measure, it's obviously only a function of rho, the radial distance along the surface. So since if we call rho squared X squared plus Y squared, a moment's consideration shows that this formula is equivalent to sigma over 4 pi kappa times 2 over the square root of a square plus rho square by putting z equals 0 in here. 2, because they're both equal from there. So that tells us the temperature distribution at the surface above a heat source. And it looks, of course, like something like this. This is the distribution plotted against the radius rho. And it's hotter naturally above the source than to one side. But this is the kind of complicated problems that geophysicists are always solving, how to tell from the surface what's going on inside. And it's very easy. It's the same kind of thing as we've been already solving. Now I would like to take a different physical analogy, completely different, just to be interesting. A completely different physical situation which gives exactly gives the same equations again. And this is a stretched rubber membrane, which we have an example here. There is this membrane here has been carefully stretched so that there's tension equally in both directions. It's not easy to do, and it probably isn't accurately done, but we're going to suppose that it's equally tense in both directions. And the problem we're going to try to solve is if various pushes and pulls are made a vertical, how much is it deflected up and down? Further, we're going to assume that the deflection is in every case small, though there's some approximations in the thing. Now before, if we look for a moment at the membrane, looking down on the membrane, it's all under tension. And that means the following, that if I would cut a 1 centimeter or unit length slit across the membrane, it would pull apart. And it's holding itself, so to speak, it's pulling on itself on each side. Or if I cut the slit and wanted to hold it from moving back here, I would have to apply a force per unit length, which I'll call tau, which is a measure of the tension in the thing. Now, however, suppose that the material, now I'm going to look at a side view, and here is the membrane on a side view, just a line. It's a two-dimensional thing, but let's look at one dimension at a time. It's just a line, and suppose, however, it's deflected, so that it's going in some kind of a curve. Then at this point here, if I did cut it, there would still be the tensions, T, almost exactly the same, if the displacements are relatively small. Let the vertical displacement, U, be a function of x and y, the horizontal positions on the surface. Well, we are only plotting x here. Then this tension, tau, exists on a line which has a slope, du dx. That's the slope. And so the vertical component of the force is tau du dx. That is, that's the vertical component of the force that the tension is applying here. If we wanted to know what the net force, however, is on a little element of the surface, you'd think, well, this thing, that one side of the element is pulled, and here's the element, and the other side is pulled, again, by the tension tau. And the net vertical force is the difference of the vertical force at these two places. And it differs because there's a curve in the thing. If they were at the same slope, it would balance out. But the net vertical force per unit length, both ways, actually, because it was one unit length this way, so per unit area, actually, is equal to the rate of change with x of tau du dx. However, there's also the curving in the y direction. And although it isn't obvious that you should just add the two, I'll let it go. You can think it out very carefully, perhaps, and find out that it is, in fact, true that if P represents the vertical force exerted by the membrane or on the membrane, that's just a matter of sign. I can never get my signs right. Vertical force per unit area, or sort of pressure, which varies over the surface of the membrane, then this is ddx of tau du dx plus ddy of tau du dy. Or, if you will, it's the same as the divergence of tau times the gradient of u. But it's two dimensions. And it's characteristic of elastic problems, even in three dimensions, that they produce similar equations. Only I'm only giving an example in two dimensions. Now, in our membrane, we'll suppose that tau is the same in all directions, and so on, as I've already assumed, but I put in the same tau in both places, and that it's a constant over the membrane. And so this can come out. And so we have the problem Laplacian nu is equal to P, where P is the vertical force. So again, the vertical displacement of the membrane replaces the electrical potential, and P replaces the charge density. Or if I want to take the case of conductors, if I push the membrane up to a definite height, that's the analog of saying that in a certain region, there's a definite potential. So, for instance, I will make a positive potential by putting in a conductor and pushing up. Then you see that here there's a certain displacement of the membrane. That's analogous to the potential. And here's the way the potential falls off. How does it fall off? Actually, logarithmically, not like 1 over r, because it's a two-dimensional problem. The force varies as 1 over r. And so you can immediately solve complicated problems. What happens with two charges? You see a positive and negative potential. There's a region where there's no field. There's a straight line through here that stays where it was before. That's correspond to the surface. No, sorry, that's the equipotential of a metal plate. And you can put two equal ones up and so on. You can solve a lot of problems. Of course, you're solving all the problems with this outside ring as a constant potential. You might think this is a very useful gadget for quickly obtaining the fields for a number of things. If you're designing a radio tube and you want to make a grid and you want to find out how much what the field looks like, you can stick a bunch of wires in here to represent the grid wire, and so on. It turns out in practice that the accuracy is not as good as direct mathematical analysis. Today, with the computing machines, the idea to use these similar equations to solve a different case by making a device like the membrane, or measuring the heat in a block and so on, it turns out that these methods, although they used to be practical, can no longer compete with direct computations. However, an interesting question comes if I have a charge and a ball which rolls, is that the same as an electron attracted by a charged wire? Almost, with several minor corrections. One of them is that there's friction. And second is that the ball rolls and has gyroscopic effects because it's twisting. So it is, again, not accurate enough to be very practical to find in the orbits of electrons, say, an electron microscope. I would like you to notice something. You know that a planet going around the sun should go in an ellipse, and that the axis of the ellipse should stay put. Let's see how it is. Here it comes. There's the maximum over there. Then the maximum is over here. Then the maximum is over here. Something's completely wrong, because the maximum should be independent of there. What's the matter? We let you worry about that. It hasn't got to do with the weight of the ball. I don't have the time to try the other balls. It works with all different weights and sizes. It's the same. And it's not the question of the rotation of the ball either. There's a very simple explanation. Now let me take another example of the same kind of business. And that has to do with the diffusion of the example of the diffusion of something, anything, one gas and another, ions in a gas. Let's take a nice one, neutrons bouncing around in a scattering in a material in which they bounce off the nuclei, and so the neutrons diffuse from place to place. If the neutrons have the same density, if n is the number of neutrons per cubic centimeter, and the neutrons have the same density everywhere, then in their helter-skelter motion, some of them, of course, will leave a given volume. Helter-skelter because they're hitting nuclei in the material. For example, neutrons diffusing in lead. They go several centimeters before they have a mean collision, but if you have or in graphite, but if you have a great big thing like a pile for the design of a reactor or something, when those dimensions are big enough compared to the mean free path, then that's the case I want to discuss. Now, if they go helter-skelter, there are as many leaving as there are coming back. But when the number is different in different places, say, for example, that the number on the right here is greater than the number here, then do this go a mean free path this way, and these go a mean free path that way, and in the mixing, there's a net flow, because more of them are coming from this side than from that side. This flow we've analyzed last year, chapter 43. It sounds like a biblical reference. And we find that the current in the x direction, which means the number of neutrons per unit area per second, which pass through in the x direction, depends upon the rate of change of the neutron density in the x direction, multiplied by the mean free path and by the speed, because the faster they go, the more they flow per second, and by a coefficient 1/3, which is the result of a lot of geometrical fiddling around. For our purposes, it's good with some kind of a constant. In any diffusion problem, there's always some constant, and that this is the definition of that constant. Now, if the difference is, this is if the difference of neutrons is in the x direction. If it's in the y direction, of course, that's the current in the y direction, so on. And now we know how to write such a relationship in a general way. If the neutrons differ from place to place, then the current is in the direction of the differences in the neutrons and so on. This is the three-dimensional generalization of what was analyzed there, where I've replaced LV over 3. That's the current of neutrons. What does that mean? The number of neutrons that flow through a unit area per second. Now, by going through integrating over surfaces or what, or considering the number that flow out of an infinitesimal volume per second, that's the divergence of J. So this is the number of neutrons generated, in that number of neutrons that flow out of a unit volume per second, and is also the same then as the number generated in the volume per second minus any the rate of change of the number in the volume if they're flowing out. This you could call the source of neutrons, and again I'll call it S, the source of neutrons, the number generated per unit volume per second. And we have an equation that looks like this, that the divergence of dN is equal to S minus dN dt, with the great equation for the diffusion of neutrons. I say it that way because Fermi taught it to me. Now, this dN dt is zero for the steady case that we're talking about, and we have an example of the same equation again. Then let's do a problem. Say, why do the problem? We've done all the problems electrostatically. I'll do it faster this time because we've done it electrostatically. Problem. We've got a block of material, and there is fission going on, or at least there are neutrons coming down, getting slowed up or something. There's a generation of neutrons here. Let's suppose that neutrons, say fission, are generating neutrons in a certain region of space. Uniform generation per cubic centimeter per second over the surface of a sphere. What is the distribution of neutrons and the same kind of material, incidentally, all around? Same D everywhere, to make it easy. Problem, what's the probability, what's the density of neutrons everywhere? In particular, question, how uniform is the neutrons over this region here where they're being generated? For instance, what's the ratio of the neutron density at the center to the neutron density at the edge? Okay, what's the problem? NDT is zero because it's a steady problem. That's exactly the same as electrostatics. The source, S naught, replaces rho. So it's a problem of a uniformly charged sphere. And the problem is to find the neutron density, and that corresponds to the potential. There's obviously something missing. I kept looking at it and wondering what I had left out. It's the gradient of N, of course, so otherwise it's a nonsense equation. N corresponds to the potential phi, so the problem is, what is the potential phi from a uniform sphere? I don't think we worked it out here in a lecture, but I'll give you the answer and you can check it by one method or another. We certainly worked out the field due to a uniformly charged sphere, inside and out, and we can integrate it to get the potential. Outside, the answer is 4 pi rho over 3 times a cubed, where a is the radius of the sphere. That's the total charge. Divided by 4 pi epsilon naught as usual, divided by r is the potential. Simplify it to rho over r, 3r, a cube. Outside. Inside, the field is a constant, and the potential varies then as the square of the distance, so its gradient will be, the field is proportional to distance. At any rate, one way or another, find out that this is the right answer. First, that the potential varies this way, and second, in order that the two things be equal, at the surface, this must be 3a squared over 2. This is the formula for the potential from a uniform sphere with the epsilon naught left out. And so you get immediately the neutron density from this other problem by saying, for instance, that the neutron density inside is equal to S naught over 4 pi d, no, 3d, times 3a squared over 2 minus r squared over 2. In other words, if this wasn't the problem that we've already done in electrostatics, it's one we should have done. Once we've done it, it's the same problem. And here's the answer. Now, what's the ratio of the center to the edge? At the center, when r is 0, it's 3a squared over 2 times stuff, At the edge, when R is A, it's 2A squared over 2 times stuff. So the neutron density at the center of the sphere to the edge of the sphere is 3/2. So now you've become a neutron expert. You can tell somebody ahead of time if you've got a source and a block, how uniform, even if the source is uniform, how uniform the neutron density will be. The actual distribution of the neutrons coming from this formula here looks like this. If this is plotted against radius, and this is radius A, then it has a parabolic form at the top, and then it has a 1 over R form further out, and the constants can all be found from this by making the slope and value check out, make a continuous curve right here. So it's a way we can solve a lot of problems. I give another example just to give the variety now in the character of the physical circumstances which will produce the same phenomena. There are a lot of others that are very similar to the fusion of gases. Doesn't have to be neutrons, it's always the same. In fact, the conductivity of electricity, the motion of ions, say, through a liquid, or electrons through a metal, same equations. However, let's take an example which is not a very good one, because this time the equations I'm going to write down are not complete and do not represent the complete study of the subject, and that has to do with the case of water flow. In the case of the membrane, they weren't complete because they were only for small deflection. But in the case of the water, it's not a question of approximation. It's a question of water doesn't like to flow the way we want it to flow. That's what it is. I'll show you what I mean. Let's talk about a liquid like water, which is incompressible, nearly, and that's flowing in different places, moving around. Then we can represent the characteristics of the water by giving the velocity at every moment, at every position, at every time. If the motion is steady, the only case for which we have an electrostatic analog, then V is independent of time. Rho times V, if rho is the density of the fluid, is the amount of matter which passes a square centimeter a second. So this is this is the current of matter. And by the conservation of matter, the divergence of this will be, in general, the rate of change of the matter inside with respect to time, plus any source of matter that there may be. By the conservation of matter, there's usually no source of matter. It's God coming with a hypodermic needle and squirting new stuff in is what this would represent. Now, if everything is constant in time, or if the liquid is incompressible, this is zero, because rho doesn't change, either because it's incompressible or it's static. Let's take the case that it's incompressible, so rho is constant, and static, so that the equation becomes the divergence of V is equal to zero. Good, we've got electrostatics again, just like divergence E equals zero. No. The electrostatics is not divergence E equals zero. It's a pair of equations. This can't be solved by itself. This just doesn't tell us enough. We need an additional equation. To match electrostatics, we'll have to have that the curl of V is zero. That corresponds to the situation where there's no circulation of the fluid. That is rather a miracle. It's not legal. Ordinarily, the liquid will develop some circulation in it. Nevertheless, because these equations are so much simpler than the case when there is circulation, a large amount of analysis has gone into what is called incompressible irrotational flow. If the curl of V is equal to zero, the flow is called irrotational. I warn you immediately that the number of circumstances in which the flow is irrotational is far from the greatest generality, by a long shot. In fact, von Neumann calls water, which is, you neglect capillarity, you know. You neglect the compressibility, and you assume that the flow is irrotational. He calls dry water. It's idealized water. Well, we're going to take care of this idealized water, and in which case, then, the velocity can be written as the gradient of some potential. And that's a solution of the lower curve with a minus sign. Now you might ask, what is the physical meaning of psi? There isn't any. The fact that the velocity can be represented as a gradient of a potential is because the flow is irrotational. And the psi is called the velocity potential and has no other significance than this, that its gradient gives the velocity. But it doesn't make any difference. We're solving mathematical equations, so we can substitute that in the other one, and we get Laplacian psi equals zero. or the divergence of the gradient of psi equals zero, and that's electrostatics. You say, oh, good, huh? Okay, it's electrostatics without any charge density. And I'll do a problem in water flow, irrotational water flow. I hope I didn't overemphasize that there are situations in which the flow is irrotational. As, for instance, a sphere falling through a liquid, if it's going not too fast and not too slow. If it's too slow, the viscous forces, which have been disregarded. Oh, I forgot that. That's part of the dry water, no viscosity. The viscous forces are too important. And if it's too fast, then you get little whirlpools and whatnot in the back, and you get circulation. But for a certain range of conditions, it's true, more or less, that the water flow is irrotational. Here's a problem. There's a sphere, and it's in a uniform stream. Let's put a sphere in a uniform stream. So far away from the sphere, the velocity is coming down this way. And of course, if I drew lines which represented, well, the analog of field lines, the lines are along to tell the direction of the velocity. Of course, they've got the bow out. They can't go through the sphere. We suppose then that the radial velocity is zero at the surface of the sphere. That means that the normal component of the velocity at the surface of a rigid solid object is zero. That's again a non-electrostatic case. That corresponds again to putting a sphere of dielectric constant zero in a uniform field. If you have worked out the solution to a problem of a sphere of a dielectric constant kappa in a uniform field, then it's merely a question of putting kappa equals zero, and you will immediately find the solution to this problem. But since we haven't actually worked that out in detail here, I'll solve this one again. First, I solve an electrostatic problem, a new one, which is new to me, because we have to find a solution where the field is uniform far away. Let's say E naught. I can't resist. I could have used V naught, the velocity, but I like to use E because I'm so used to it, you see. And the problem is to get a solution such that at a radius A, the radial component of E is zero at A. That is, if E is gradient phi, the rate of change of phi with respect to R, which is this, minus, okay, but zero is the same both ways, ha-ha, is equal to zero at A. So our problem is a new one, or a new kind of boundary condition, not that phi is a constant, but that its gradient is a constant. It's a little bit different. What's the answer? Well, it's not easy to get the answer immediately. First of all, the phi begins, it would be E0z. This would be the phi if there were no sphere. The gradient of this phi is E naught. Minus gradient is E naught. And my arrowheads are upside down as usual. Now, what else? The z-axis is this way. All right. Now, study in the case of a dielectric sphere, we have analyzed by imagining a uniform polarization inside the sphere. But in this problem, we're only interested in the field outside. So the field outside is a superposition for a dielectric sphere of a uniform field and a dipole. Let us try the same kind of a solution as a guess here. So we suppose that the solution is that of a uniform field plus a dipole. Now, the potential from a dipole looks like that. Only what's the strength P? Unknown. Well, this, we need to, in order to find it, P, I'm going to use this condition on phi. In order to differentiate with respect to R, I must do so at constant angle theta. So I'll express this in terms of theta, and I'll write it like this. E naught times, let's first write it like this. E naught times Z plus some coefficient A times Z over R cubed. You see, we don't know what P is anyway, and we can get rid of all this by just calling A so that E naught A equals this. Anyway, the form is mathematically this form, which is equal to E naught cosine theta. You see, Z on a point in this world is always equal to R cosine theta. So putting z equal r cosine theta, I get r plus a over r squared. And now it's easy to differentiate phi with respect to r and set it equal to 0. d phi dr is equal to minus E naught times cosine theta times the derivative of R, which is 1, minus 2A. Oh, that's terrible. Let me change this A to capital A. I'm using little a for the radius of the sphere, and that's a terrible thing to do then. So this is capital A, divided by R cubed. That's the derivative of this. Now we can make this equal to 0 by just choosing at the surface R equal A, if capital A times 2 is equal to A cubed. And therefore, the final solution is that the that the potential psi is equal to minus V naught times cosine theta times R minus 1 half A cubed over R square, and that from this all the velocities can be obtained. I suddenly transformed all my junk from the electric field to the velocity. So there's a solution to the velocity, and you can find out what it looks like, and you can draw the lines and so on and see how exactly the water flows around the sphere. I would like to make a remark about what happened here. You say, look, you assumed it was a dipole on top of a uniform field. Suppose I had assumed something else, then I could have found a constant too, and I would have been wrong. How do you know that you've got a right answer? And the answer is this. If I hadn't got the right formula here, then it would have been impossible to adjust the gradient to 0 everywhere on the surface of the sphere. The fact that the answer gives 0 for all values of cosine theta simultaneously means I've got the right formula. If I had, for instance, any other function of angle in here but cosine theta, then I couldn't balance these two terms all around the sphere. So what I really need is the single case of a potential which varies as cosine theta and which falls off with distance. And the only potential which varies as cosine theta and falls off with distance is z over r cubed, or cosine theta over r squared. The other solution that varies with cosine theta, incidentally, if you remove the restriction that it falls off with distance, is necessarily z or r cosine theta. And those are the only solutions which vary as cosine theta. There are two of them, r and 1 over r square. And the relative proportions depend on the problem in general. But any linear combination is, of course, again, a solution. Now let's see if I have another example of this. I have one more example, which I will not going to carry out very far, but it's of a completely different type again, in order to show the possible varieties of possibility. That's a heck of a sentence, the possible varieties of possibility. However, we hope that the note makers will correct it. This time, I'm not going to do something with a differential equation, but something which leads to the same integral as the integrals which were involved in electricity when we would try to solve the equations in integral form. See, if we have a mathematical problem which gives us a certain integral, then we know something about the properties of that integral if it's the same integral as we had to do for another problem. Example. Here's a light source, a single light source, and here's a plane underneath. The question is, what is the intensity of light on the surface of the plane? You can do curved surfaces and so on. We'll just do the easiest example. Illumination engineering. Okay, out of the source of light comes light, which we'll suppose is spherically symmetrical and going in all directions, so that the amount of energy which passes through a unit area at right angles to the light varies inversely as the square of the distance. But the intensity on the surface of this plane, which is the amount of energy that falls on a unit area of this plane, is less than this, than the amount which is flowing per unit area away from here, because the light which is going between A and B is spread between A and C a longer distance. So the intensity of light here is weaker than 1 over R square by the cosine of the angle. In fact, after much thought, you can see that the intensity of light in the direction normal to this plane is given by the same kind of a formula as the electric field from a source. It's the source times over R square times a unit vector in the direction of r. Dot the normal to the surface. This is the cosine angle, which corrects for the slope of the surface. To make it less complicated, since I take a source and a plane, then the intensity here is the same as the vertical component of electric field would be from a point charge. Okay, knowing that, that means that if we have any distribution of lights, we get the same answer for the illuminations on, say, a plane as we would get if we calculated the vertical component of electric field on that plane due to a distribution of charges analogous to the lights. Example, we wish for some very difficult experimental situation to arrange that a plane have a uniform illumination. We have available long tubes, fluorescent lights, which are uniform this way, but we have to put them along at a certain spacing. So we have long tubes, which we'll draw in three dimensions, see, which are a distance, we put them a distance A apart, and we ask how far away must we put those tubes so that the field is uniform, say, within one part in a thousand. That the light illumination, therefore the electric field and the correspondence, is uniform to one part in a thousand. Answer, find the electric field from a series of wires, each charged uniformly, the vertical component of the electric field, and then see how far away you have to go so that the little sinusoidal ripple that we discussed once before is reduced to one part of a thousand. It turns out to be about 1.2 times the distance between the wires only, surprisingly enough. But I won't go into the detailed analysis of that. I just illustrate the point that you get the same answer. You got another problem in which you have to use the results of electrostatics. And there, my main point, therefore, is that you've learned a lot more than you think you've learned when you learn one particular subject. And then that's the reason why it's possible in a limited number of years to learn all of the physics. Now the question comes, however, at the end of such a subject, is why are the equations from different phenomena so uniform? Oh, of course, it's the underlying unity of nature, whatever that means. What could it mean? It could mean that the equations are uniform in different phenomena. Then it's no explanation. But it may mean something else. It may mean this by the underlying unity. Everything is made out of the same stuff. And therefore, it obeys the same equations. It's made out of the same stuff. It sounds like a good explanation, but let's think. The electrostatic potential, the density of neutrons, the temperature, are they made of the same stuff? Can we see electrostatic can we imagine electrostatic potential as analogous to the thermal motion of something? Or to the density of particles. That's not analogous. That's not exactly the same as a thermal motion of particles. And then the thing gets worse when you realize another possible analogy is to have U, the displacement of a membrane. It's the space of a membrane. It's not like a temperature. And so it gets difficult to understand the things. They're not made of the same stuff, yet they obey the same equations. As a matter of fact, the fact that they obey the same equations have led people to make physical analogies, say, imagine that electric field is like the streaming of light. We talked about that example. It doesn't help any. It doesn't help you to understand it in a more complicated circumstances. Imagine that the electric field is like elastic deflections of things that are stiff. Then the equations of Maxwell may be understood, perhaps, as being the equations of an elastic material, the ether. This has turned out not to be useful because the particular equations are simpler than the elastic equation would be for any substance. In fact, a closer look at the physics shows that the equation, for example, for the neutrons is really wrong. That's only true when the distances over which you're looking are large compared to the mean free path. Even worse, of course, if you look close enough, you'd see the individual neutrons. And certainly watching the neutrons is going to be a completely different looking thing than the smooth variation involved in this nice differential equation. So that the differential equation is an approximation. It's because we assume the neutrons are smooth in space. And is it possible that that's the clue? That the thing which is common to all the phenomena is the space, the framework into which the physics is put. As long as things are reasonably smooth in space, Then the important things that will be involved will be the rate of change in space, which will be things like the gradient and so on. And it has to be like the gradient and so on because of the fact that the laws of physics are independent of direction, so they have to come in vector form. And these are the simplest vector equations that you can get involving derivatives of things in space. So it's possible that the reason is that what is common is in this situation, what is common in a situation that is in space, and second, that we are so large that we are not looking in these phenomena at the details of the small distances, and so we imitate a much more complicated phenomenon by a sloppy differential equation. That leads us to another possibility. Is that true also for the electrostatic equations? Can I explain the fact that these are the right electrostatic equations by saying that this is a smoothed-out version of the truth, that the reason we need the gradients and so on is because the real world consists of little children that are moving around at very tiny distances, and that when we see in our real measurements, we're always measuring at such a big scale that we can't see the little, and therefore we get these differential equations. People have tried to make a models like this. Not very many people have tried, I'm afraid. And our electrodynamics has its failures or suggested failures at very short distances. And so it is possible, in principle, that these equations are smoothed out versions of something. But today, they still look right as far down as we've gone, which is 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. But then they begin to look wrong, and it's possible that it's because there's an underlying machinery, and that in fact, the smooth-looking equations, like the smooth diffusion of neutrons, is hiding the details of an underlying complexity. Nobody has formulated a theory that works that way. As a matter of fact, it turns out rather strange, and in a way that I do not understand at all, that the combination of relativity and quantum mechanics seems to forbid anybody to invent an equation that's any different than this, I mean, fundamentally, with the same differential form, which doesn't lead to some kind of contradiction, fundamentally. Not a disagreement with experiment, but a contradiction, like the probability of all events, all possibilities added together is not equal to one, or that energies are complex numbers, or some other such idiocy. So no one has made up a theory with a mechanism underneath electricity which doesn't lead, ultimately, to some kind of an absurdity. Thank you. Jack it up
complain.
A bit.
You can't complain that that was a dull subject.
No, they liked that, didn't they? Okay, I got it.
I mean, you can't complain.
No, I can't complain. I found something to say at the end, you see.
Yeah.
I think that's the secret of each one.
Right.
Something to say
right.
At the beginning, yeah. Something to say at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to figure it out. And if you can't figure it out, it means you've got the wrong subject.
Right.
Don't push too very hard because it might break. What?
You see
yeah. You want me to explain or you're joking? You're joking about cutting.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, right. But I'm not going to show you that. See, it doesn't go in an ellipse. You know why?
You've got a boundary.
Now, that's pretty far out. That's
yeah,
not...
Even if we put it right in here.
See, it's out here, then it's out here, and it doesn't work at all. It's very simple, the reason. In fact, you see why I mention is because I let go of it, I said, it's going to go in a nice ellipse. And then it went in this crazy form. I said, what the hell? And I stopped and thought for a minute or two, and then I saw what.
I like that one.
Yeah,
that's reasonable.
Yeah, that solution is all right. See, it hasn't got to do with the weight of the balls. You can get... the same phenomenon with another weight. It's not to do with the fact that it settles itself into them. It's quite striking, you see.
Hey, he's setting some free body problems here.
Here. I worked out this thing exactly with the 1.1, but I didn't do it because it'd take too long.
Well, how long has it been? Why? You said you knew you had the right answer.
I said this. you might ask why you can add anything, why not add anything at all and make the adjustment? Because the secret is this, that I have been able to make this thing equal to zero everywhere on the surface of the sphere with one constant. If this thing hadn't varied with the right angularly correct, if it wasn't varying as cosine theta, but in some other function of the angle, I couldn't have made, if the cosine didn't factor out, I couldn't have made it zero all around at the same time. I could have made it zero here, but then it wouldn't have been zero there. So it had to vary as cosine theta.
This term has to be independent of theta.
That's right, exactly. Then I can make it zero. But that's because there's a z, oh yeah, and any other distribution of charge would not produce the z here. See, this term here varies as cosine theta. So I need another potential. Because that doesn't make any difference. The problem is how it varies with angle.
Yeah. Oh. Cosine theta was a solution then also.
Right.
Something about cosine theta.
Oh, I said this, that if you, that the following, I made a remark, an additional remark, which may, that if you know that the potential varies as cosine theta in angle, then there is, and further know that it falls off with, as you go away, then I said there's only one solution known. I mean, it's all there is. It's 1 over r squared cosine theta, the field of a dipole. That's the only possibility. I just stated that. Second, I said, though, that there is another solution which does vary as cosine theta, but if you do, if we remove the restriction that it has to go as 1 over r squared, and that solution is r cosine theta. Given the cosine theta angular dependence, there's only two possible solutions. One is r and the other is 1 over r squared. And any linear combination is another solution. And I have the only possible solution here. But this is a little bit more esoteric. We'll come back to this stuff later. The main point is that the thing canceled for all I theta simultaneously. And if you had tried anything else, you wouldn't have been able to do it. What, for instance? You want to put z over r here? Is that what you're worried about? Yes. Right. Right. It has to be a solution of the way of the equation in empty space out here. It has to be the solution that belongs to some no charge. It has to satisfy Laplacian phi equals zero. It must be from some kind of distribution of image charges in here. So the only solution out there of empty space is z over r cubed for a dipole in here. It can't be z over r, because z over r wouldn't be a solution of Laplacian phi equals zero outside. If you took the Laplacian, you wouldn't get zero. So first you say the Laplacian is zero. Then the solution is in a uniform field or the dipole or anything else of charges in here. But only the dipole has the cosine theta that you need to make it cancel. Yeah. Oh, the right way to understand these things is you just simply took a guess and it worked. Because, you see, you hope that by understanding how the guess worked, you'll be able to make guesses in the future. But it doesn't work. You just have to fiddle around, yeah. What? You know why it's, you know why it doesn't work? It took me a minute or two after I saw it didn't work. I said, God damn it. I thought I was going to show them the elliptical orbits, and they were cockeyed. I thought, friction. No, not friction. Gyroscope. No, not gyroscope. Too big.
You didn't
say one of the other reasons why I've always thought why all these equations fit, too, and that is that we only know how to handle certain equations,
so we choose the kind of things and
make the approximation. I mean, certainly the membrane is very wrong. And we say, well, everything's small. So
I thought of, to make it a little bit different, the same general idea, but I forgot when I went to talk. Mm-hmm. Another possibility is that
those things we can describe.
Only those things which we solve, we talk about. And the ones that are the same as something we did before, we know about. And so we only write down those. And it might mention that as a, I forgot to say.